From the New Testament, we turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, only two verses. What then, brethren, when you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. If any speak in a tongue, let there be only two, or at most three, and each in turn, and let one interpret.
Good morning. Is this the right loudness for you all? Thank you for letting me come and share a piece of my life with you. And I want to remind you that this church has a tradition of having members share stories and share about their lives and what they've learned. And I just really open it up to all of you to think if there's something you'd like to share with all of us. And I'm learning. I'm not nervous, but if you don't learn to public speak often enough, I run out of air. So I'm not nervous, but I might run out of air and have to breathe a little. Almost 50 years ago, I was a young woman living in San Luis Obispo, California. I became involved with an organization called Reevaluation Counseling, or Co-Counseling. Some of you in this congregation, I know, are familiar with this movement. I became a teacher of reevaluation counseling and subsequently decided I would like to become a licensed counselor. I earned a master's degree in counseling from the California Polytechnic State University and became a licensed marriage, family, and child counselor. Part of the master's degree program was an internship at a medium security prison called the California Men's Colony. It was also located in San Luis Obispo, California. I worked with men individually and in groups for my internship. At that time, I knew another woman who was involved in reevaluation counseling who developed an adaptation of co-counseling for use in jails and prisons. And after I completed my internship, I was hired part-time by the prison to implement the experimental program over several months. I'm telling you this so that you have some context for how I came to work with the men I'm about to tell you about. When I tell some people about this work, they often wonder out loud if it wasn't difficult to talk to and listen to men who had committed serious crimes. Most of the time, it wasn't difficult. The work I did was outside the usual structures and systems of the prison. I couldn't help them get out any sooner, and if you're in prison, the focus of your life is how to get out. I couldn't help them and I couldn't hurt them. So they were freed from trying to convince me that they were now a model human being. This freed both of us to just be two people together. I don't doubt that my being a young woman helped to spark some curiosity about sitting down and talking to me. As I've indicated, I knew these men almost 50 years ago. And some of you may be frustrated that I don't remember more details if I ever knew them. I'm sharing with you what I remember after all these years. The first person I'm going to tell you about is Larry. Larry was a young man in prison for child molestation. You may not realize it, but I've just told you a great deal about Larry. He was young, and he was in prison. This tells us he was discovered, arrested, tried, convicted, and sent to prison. Larry had not figured out an essential aspect of what one could call successful sexual predation. He had not figured out how to convince his victims, in this case children, to be silent. Silencing victims takes many forms, and as we all know all too well from the news, many of the perpetrators are not caught for a long time. They are successful in silencing their victims, whether they are children, as with pedophile priests, or all too often, young women. Sexual predation always occurs in secret. There are no pictures or evidence of what has happened for others to see. As I mentioned, Larry was a relatively young man, and I learned a lot from him. If you were to have met him, he was a pleasant enough young person. What you wouldn't know was that he did not know how to have an adult relationship with a woman, perhaps with any adult. I met Larry almost 50 years ago, and unfortunately, I doubt the situation for American families with children has improved since then. Families are stressed and strapped, and when an acquaintance or a neighbor who seems fine, likes children, gets along with your children, offers to babysit your children so that you and your spouse can get away for a little time together, you too might jump at the chance to take advantage of the offer. I think in Larry's case, he did not intend to sexually use the children he knew. His inability to form healthy adult relationships that could meet his needs for emotional intimacy and sexual intimacy led him down a path of investing in his relationships with children in ways that were unhealthy. As we know, he did not succeed in silencing the children. And they were able to say to another adult enough about their discomfort so that Larry was discovered and stopped. Compare this Larry with Larry Nassar, the former USA Gymnastics national team doctor and physician at Michigan State University. By the time things finally began to unravel in 2017, Larry Nassar was accused of assaulting 250 young women and girls and one young man dating back to 1992. That's 25 years. In February 2017, three former gymnasts reported in a 60 Minutes interview that Larry Nassar had sexually assaulted them. They described how the emotionally abusive environment at the national team training camps gave Nassar the opportunity to take advantage of gymnasts and made them afraid to speak up about what had happened to them. As you may remember, Larry Nassar had a reputation of being able to help young female gymnasts with physical problems that might limit their ability to excel. In the world of gymnastics, the pressure to succeed is intense. Status and power often make it easier for a perpetrator to get away with victimizing behavior and keep victims silent. Apparently, Nassar became so adept at inappropriately touching the young women gymnasts that the parents of a young woman could be in the room while he performed an examination, and he would position his body in such a way that the parents could not see what they were doing and subsequently not believe their daughters. When Larry Nassar was tried and convicted, he was sentenced to 60 years in federal prison and 174 years in Michigan State Prison. We know that no matter how long Larry Nassar is locked up, it will not undo the trauma experienced by the people he abused. All groups of people who have less power or status are more at risk for being victimized. This always includes women and children, also immigrant groups and people of color, and any group of people who are stigmatized and not valued by the majority culture. This is a deep and systemic problem in our culture and in many cultures. Sexual victimization depends upon secrecy, power imbalance, and that the victimizer will use that power to create conditions in which breaking silence is not an option. We can speak up about the value of all people and that it isn't okay to use other people for your own sexual pleasure. We can listen to the people in our lives. We can work for a world in which human touch is healing and not hurtful. And we can work for a world where sexual relationships are characterized by mutual desire and full consent of adults. The next person I want to tell you about is Stuart Miller. And if I could have seen him again today and sat down with him and talked to him about the chance I had to share his story, some of his story with people, I know what he would have wanted me to say to you. We know that many aspects of human suffering are exacerbated by low socioeconomic status. People who do not have adequate financial resources are at much greater risk of not having adequate food, safe housing, or medical care. But Stuart would want you to know that some things, such as cruelty, abuse, mental illness, substance abuse, and domestic violence, occur across all levels of society. It was his opinion that his father's status as a prominent member of society in Los Angeles and his public persona made it difficult for people to believe Stuart when he tried to get help for the abuse he was experiencing in his family. Stuart was in prison for murder. When he committed his crime, he was a young man and in a private residential psychiatric hospital. He fell in love with another patient, a young woman. She did not return his interest. Stuart was devastated. He got a day pass, found a gun store, bought a gun, returned to the hospital, and shot and killed the young woman. I met Stuart quite a few years later when he had been in prison for 10 or more years. He told me that somehow he had managed to gain his sanity during his time in prison. The parole board often looks for remorse when evaluating a person for possible release. If ever there was a person who felt remorse, it was Stuart. He had asked for a way to convey his feelings to the young woman's family, but they were not interested in having any contact with him. It was distressing to him that he couldn't express his sadness and intense regret to the family. We know from statistics that the vast majority of people with serious mental illness are never violent in any way. Mental illness is strongly associated with the increased risk of suicide and of being the victim of violence. The majority of Americans, unfortunately, do believe that people with mental illness are more dangerous than other people, and every time there's a mass shooting, the discussion somehow turns to the need to improve access to mental health care as a way of reducing gun violence. We do need to improve access to mental health care, but not as a way of reducing gun violence. I knew Stuart near the end of his time of being incarcerated. I was in touch with him for a while after he was released. I felt hopeful for his future. His plan was to join an Orthodox Jewish community in New York. And I had shared this piece of the story with some folks earlier, and they said I had to share this. As Stuart was in his negotiations with this group, he was, you know, Stuart was Jewish, but this was a very Orthodox Jewish community, and he had to be recircumcised to meet the requirements of this very Orthodox community. But his hope was to go there and live where he would be allowed to take a wife and to work and to have a full life. A very natural question to ask after hearing this story is if some gun laws, such as background checks, could have prevented this tragedy. I certainly don't know the answer to that question. Certainly whether any laws could prevent someone, such as Stuart, from purchasing a gun would depend upon the law, how the laws are written and implemented. Unfortunately, I think that his family, in their great investment in appearances and status, would have done everything they could to prevent information about Stuart, namely that he was having mental health issues and was in a residential psychiatric hospital, from getting into any kind of database that would facilitate identifying him as someone who should not be allowed to purchase a firearm. I don't remember questioning Stuart about this fact, but it's also hard for me not to think that the hospital must have missed some clues, or they would have known more what was going on with him. I do know that Stuart himself would have wanted to have been prevented from purchasing a gun. He did not want to harm anyone. The last person I want to tell you about is Clay. If you would have met Clay, he would have reminded you of Garfunkel from Simon and Garfunkel with his curly, sandy-colored hair. Clay was also in prison for murder. Clay killed a man in a barroom brawl. Again, I met Clay years after he was arrested and first incarcerated and near the time when he was going to be released. He told me how, when he was in prison and could no longer get drunk and live a life of total chaos, and he had to just be with what was going on in his mind, he discovered that he felt helpless to have any control over his thoughts, emotions, and resultant behaviors. He was at the mercy of the crazy thinking and violent emotional reactions he had to every event in his life. At some point, Clay learned about meditation. 50 years ago, ideas about and articles about and research about meditation was not as common as it is today, but meditation was known. Transcendental meditation was being taught all over the country, and meditation is something that's been known to human beings for much of humanity. So he became interested in meditation, and it was something he could do himself. He didn't need anyone else to try to learn to meditate. Clay related to me how he tried to be quiet for little snatches of time over and over and over and over again, just the same as probably all of you if you've tried to practice. He spent his free time trying to learn how to quiet his mind 1 minute or 5 minutes at a time. He was able to identify and write to an organization of people who were regular members, regular meditators in the area. He was thrilled when a woman from the local organization came to visit him. I didn't keep in touch with Clay, but I felt encouraged that Clay could do well when he was released. Again, he had discovered a way to create community and connection for himself. At the time I knew him, which was before he was released, he was still apprehensive about what it would be like to once again be in the unpredictable give and take of open society. He didn't know yet how effective meditation would be for him when confronted by all of the old triggers. His plan was to parole to a very sparsely populated area where he could, he hoped, limit the amount of potential conflict in his life as he became more confident in his ability to deal with life in the real world. So, as you go out into the world, remember that you can make a difference. We can work for a world where sexual relationships are based on mutual desire and consent, never on power imbalance, coercion, and intimidation. We can remember that people with mental illness are not more violent than anyone else, but actually are at greater risk of abuse and violence. We can rejoice in the fact that human beings look for ways to heal their body, their mind, and their spirit, even in unlikely places such as a men's prison. Thank you. Anybody have a question or a comment?
Good morning, I'm Charlie. Elsie, I just want to thank you for sharing today. It was very inspiring, and you held my attention every minute. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you. What else?
Elsie, I got to admit, I started not to come to church today, and I'm glad I did. Thank you so much for your message.
Thank you. I'm so glad it was worth coming. Anyone else?
This is my first time here, and I want to say thank you for what you shared today. As a survivor of sexual abuse, it means a lot that you brought it to light. And when you mentioned people in power in a position of authority, it happened to be two police officers that did it. And the way they shut me up was to threaten me with planting drugs on me and convicting me of a felony and sending me away. So it's the people. So what really shocked me was it was the people that you were supposed to be able to call in an instance when that was to happen. But I want to thank you because you allowed me to at least acknowledge it. So thank you.
You are very welcome, and thank you for sharing that. And I hope you will find healing. I know you will in this church with these people.
And on my part, welcome. We're glad you're here.